This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Okay, great. So I thought I would give a sort of short talk, just an overview of the book and some of the themes I'm dealing with, and then just read a few sections to give sort of flavor for the writing and how I deal with the topic. So the book is titled The Trouble with Pleasure, and the kind of starting point is actually that very commonsensical idea that pleasure is good and pain is bad, or that the human being is oriented in its beliefs, desires, actions, behaviors, and so on by the compass of pleasure, that we act to gain pleasure and to avoid pain. And after all, this is an idea that still informs a lot of psychology, philosophy, moral philosophy, and also of economics, economic theory, maximization of your interests of goods. Now, the basic thesis of this book is that pleasure is actually a very complex phenomenon, and that the relationship to pleasure is something that's confused, difficult, and contradictory, and that is even what makes it so pleasurable. So against this kind of consensus one still finds in philosophy, psychology, and economics, I want to propose a much more sort of nuanced investigation into the human relationship to pleasure and pain. Nietzsche has a wonderful line about this. As he once wrote, man does not seek pleasure, only the Englishman does. Now, one of the main examples so that I use to illustrate the complexity of the relationship to pleasure and the phenomena of pleasure, its kind of multiform nature, is complaining. So I start the book, or I want to start off, with a kind of counterintuitive or surprising example of what pleasure is. And I think complaining is actually one of the best phenomena, one of the kind of most interesting practices to investigate to understand what really drives people, what really motivates people, and where they find enjoyment. Now, I take complaining as a kind of quasi-universal human pastime or human activity that has very interesting cultural and historical variations across time. And one could say that complaining, so the kind of universality of complaining, bears witness to the fact that desire is always, to some extent, to some degree, unsatisfied, that the human being is always lacking something. And you could ask, well, what is it that the human being is lacking? And you could say, well, it's the pleasure of complaining itself. In this way, you would seem to form a kind of perfect circle. One needs to lack something in order to have the pleasure of kvetching about it. But on the other hand, somehow this lack and this surplus don't meet up. It doesn't form a kind of harmony. And that's also one of the basic themes that I explore, that human desire has to be analyzed in terms of, on the one hand, a kind of lack, missing something, a dissatisfaction, and on the other hand, something that's too much, or something that's doesn't a kind of object or an extra satisfaction that doesn't exactly find its place in life. So on the one hand, there's a kind of lack, and on the other hand, a surplus. One of the ways I talk about this is with the idea of questions and answers. And of course, we all know that this is almost a kind of philosophical cliche, that when philosophers talk about questions, they always talk about questions without answers. Questions without answers. These are the only kind of questions that really interest philosophers, questions that can't be answered. Now, why is that? Of course, there are many reasons for that, and one could analyze the kind of structure of philosophical discourse to understand why it is that certain questions don't have so obvious answers, but why certain questions are so difficult, complex, rich, that they actually provide a kind of plethora of meanings, that they're sort of inexhaustible. But there's also another way of looking at that, and that's through the prism of pleasure. Why do philosophers like questions without answers? Because philosophers are people who find pleasure in the activity of thinking. That's what defines a philosopher. And in fact, if you look at ancient philosophy, the debates about hedonism in Greek philosophy, one of the most interesting aspects that's been ignored in the literature, and even in kind of the most recent revivals, for example, of the Greek thinking of hedonism. I'm thinking of the work of Michel Foucault, for example. One of the aspects that's often ignored is that the Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, others, held that philosophy is not only an example of pleasure, but philosophy is the greatest pleasure. Nobody will defend this today, that philosophy is actually the most exciting, intense activity you could undertake. Of course, we're all, in a way, kind of Freudians today, that we immediately think that sexuality, sex, is the kind of gold standard of all pleasures. But that was not obvious for the Greeks. So I also take seriously this claim that thinking is the best pleasure. Now, if you're a philosopher and you like to think, it means that you have pleasure in the activity of thinking, so that your activity can go on and on. And you have to feed that activity with new kinds of inquiries. That means the only thing that really makes a philosopher sad is finding an answer. Because if you find an answer, it means that your thinking comes to an end. So if you do find an answer, it has to be a kind of answer that actually immediately proposes, launches a new kind of question, so your inquiry can begin again. Let me give you a very simple example of this kind of limitless character of pleasure. Again, if you're a philosopher and you enjoy thinking, it means that your thinking doesn't really have a limit. That poses a problem because, after all, philosophers still have bodies, which means that they get tired, which means they have to sleep, they have to go to the bathroom, and they have to eat and all these things. All those things interrupt the pure pleasure of thinking. So you can devise kind of different methods so as to ignore the body so that you can continue with your preferred activity. So, for example, you can smoke a cigarette or you can drink coffee. That way you don't have to go to bed. This can also become compulsive insofar as perhaps you can't sleep at night because you're still thinking about that problem, that still that activity of thinking is going on even in spite of yourself. Now, I know this is a kind of ridiculous example, but I prefer, and that's also kind of one of the strategies I use in the book, I prefer to use very simple examples to illustrate things like the limitless character of pleasure rather than immediately going for very spectacular examples, for example, a la Georges Bataille, for instance. Now, philosophers are people, again, to reiterate, who talk about questions without answers. But perhaps it could be interesting to turn around that cliche and talk about answers without questions. I'm also kind of interested in answers without questions. So an answer that sort of arrives without any sort of previous inquiry. Let me say this is an interesting model for thinking about desire, because normally we always think of desire in terms of a search, an active search for something. Desire is looking for something, it's missing what it's looking for, and it's even enjoying that restlessness, for example. That's one typical way of understanding desire, this restless force that never sort of finds its object. But you could also propose just the opposite, that sometimes one discovers something without looking for it. And that thing that you didn't want, you weren't looking for it, you had no preceding desire, can bring you a strange sort of surprising pleasure, as if there was suddenly an answer to a problem that you never even knew you had. This is what Plato calls pure or true pleasure. I think that's a very interesting way of looking at the phenomenon of pleasure, that it's not a lack or kind of search for something, but it's a kind of pure surplus that somehow you didn't even know you wanted and creates trouble. Because it doesn't correspond, perhaps, with your ideas, beliefs, preceding desires, and so forth. So I think in psychoanalysis, one of the formulas I use for this is that you learn that the only way to answer a question without an answer is with an answer without a question. Okay. Complaining. Complaining also brings up the question of the problem, so the philosophical problem of negativity, the meaning of negativity. And that's one of the reasons why, so the book, in a more academic sense, is really axed on two authors, Jacques Lacan and Gilles Deleuze. So I'm also trying to, the book also kind of indulges in that very classical academic genre of comparing and contrasting two thinkers. But the way I've done that is always trying to frame that conversation or dialogue that I construct between these thinkers with kind of unlikely examples that don't necessarily come from either Lacan or Deleuze. So the idea is, I think this is a kind of indispensable genre. If there's students or professors here, everybody knows this. It's a kind of indispensable academic genre, the compare and contrast. So I think if there's an interesting way of doing it, it's to somehow dislodge or to knock both of the characters a little bit off their territory, a little bit off their convenient ground, or a little outside their usual vocabularies. So that's also the kind of strategy, why I began with a long chapter about complaining that, in a sense, neither Deleuze nor Lacan really dwell on at length, although I'll come back to that. Deleuze has some very interesting things to say about complaining. So, complaining is a way of looking at the problem of negativity. And the other reason why I kind of am interested in complaining is because I think it's been given really a short shrift in intellectual history and in philosophy. So, as one knows, intellectuals are always talking about two things, criticism and especially critique. Occasionally, they also invent really sort of ungainly expressions. So I hope you've never come across this word, but one also talks of criticality, for instance. So criticism, critique, and criticality. But nobody talks about complaining. So my thesis is that complaining is somehow the anthropological substratum of criticism and critique. That criticism and critique come out of that everyday practice shared by everybody, practically everybody. I hope everybody. Nothing is worse than somebody who never complains. Nothing is worse than somebody who also complains about other people's complaining incessantly, for instance. Okay. That somehow criticism and critique should be understood as coming out of a universal anthropological practice of complaining, which at its basics, you know, the most basic sort of elementary level is an expression of negativity. So one could say that criticism and critique are refined forms, refinements, sublimations, if you want, transformations of complaining. And specifically, I'll get to this point in a moment, specifically, they kind of refer to the neurotic personality. So that the kind of complaining we have, and the very kind of highly developed form of complaining we have in sort of intellectual criticism or critique or in philosophy is a kind of very refined, beautiful kind of neuroticism. Okay. Complaining is a very capacious, it's a very broad category. So on the one hand, I play a lot with the kind of humoristic value of, okay, everybody sort of is predisposed, I think, against complaining. That we're constantly being told that you should stop complaining, or if you do complain, you should make sure your complaint is meaningful, and that, you know, you should channel your complaints into kind of socially productive forms of protest, but you shouldn't whine or moan or grumble or whatnot. So I want to kind of go against this sort of common sense and sort of raise complaining to a certain kind of dignity, philosophical or conceptual dignity. I think complaining really is a broad category that covers all sorts of different, so not only this kind of self-indulgent, what we often think of this kind of self-indulgent sort of whining, but all kinds of protest, of lamentation, of mourning, again, of kvetching, I'll come to that in a moment, the specificity of that across different cultures. And one of the questions you can ask as a philosopher is, what is then the ultimate complaint, or what is the pure form? Could we isolate one kind of formula for complaining? Are all complaints revolving around one kind of complaint? And here I think Deleuze and Lacan are very interesting because they both propose a kind of pure complaint. So kind of complaint all other complaints relate to. Now, the Lacanian answer would be this kind of joke, a Jewish joke that Freud tells, actually in his book on jokes and their relation to the unconscious. And it's relating to Sophocles. So in, not Oedipus Rex, but in Oedipus at Colonus, you have this kind of famous phrase of the chorus, where the chorus says, you know, it would be, you know, commenting on the kind of terrible plight of Oedipus, the chorus says, it would be better never to have been born. But being born, the next best thing is to go back to where you came from as quickly as possible. So in Greek, this famous negation of nature itself, this mephunai, as if nature itself should not emerge. And the joke goes like this, it's better never to have been born. Unfortunately, that only happens once every 100,000 times. So this idea that not only is non-being the best thing, but unfortunately non-being doesn't happen that often. So this is a kind of pure form of complaint that you could say behind every complaint, ultimately, there's a kind of extravagant protest against being itself. So my hypothesis would be, maybe not in every complaint, but any complaint, from the most minor, ridiculous complaint, you know, oh, my shoes are untied again, something really trivial, to the most kind of horrible complaint, really expression of extreme pain or lamentation. Behind that, you can hear an echo of a more extravagant, of a more profound complaint, which is never to be. And that this echo of this idea of never being born is what gives to complaining its kind of power and its elan, so that complaining is never simply a purely empirical matter. And you would never arrive at the conclusion it's best not to be born from kind of weighing up pleasures and pains. It's not a question of an empirical kind of deduction, where you say, well, there are certain pleasures in life, of course, but of course the pains are really horrible and they sort of outweigh each other. I'm not interested in that at all. I have nothing to say about this kind of weighing pleasures and pains. I think that there's actually a kind of more extravagant level where this whole idea of weighing becomes sort of derisory in light of an ultimate kind of wrong that simply can't be bargained with at all. And that ultimate wrong is simply coming into being as such. So that's Lacan's idea, that somehow the subject, in its most pure state, is a kind of protest against its existence. The subject itself is a kind of failed existence. I won't go into great detail about that because that's kind of a longer derivation or longer argumentation. But what I argue is that against a kind of common sense vitalism, so against the idea that we feel our life in ourselves, we feel the pressure of our drives, we feel our joys and pains. So against this idea that the human being is sort of naturally alive, I think that actually the human being is a kind of sick animal that doesn't live its life. It doesn't live its life directly, but lives its failure not to be born. So that our life is a kind of double negation, that it's not that we directly live, but somehow we failed not to be born, and therefore we're here. And that gives a sort of extra dimension, a kind of extravagance to the human desire. Now, Deleuze has a different take on this, and a very interesting one. Incidentally, so for those who are maybe familiar with the philosophy of Deleuze, Deleuze is often identified as a kind of thinker of affirmation, a thinker of creativity, of difference. And he very explicitly has a great philosophical polemic against the category of negativity and against, you know, the great philosopher of negativity, namely Hegel. I kind of want to cut against this kind of image of Deleuze. And one of the kind of examples that I find very stimulating is that in his interviews, so this interview, this ABCs of Deleuze, Abécédaire, given quite late in his life, and it was actually released after he died, he goes through the alphabet and kind of gives a little philosophical discourse for each letter. And when he comes to, so J for joy, joie, he actually, the primary example he gives is complaining. And that's interesting. It's not what one would suspect if you sort of have a rudimentary knowledge of Deleuze. And even the interviewer is a bit suspect there. And she asks, well, if in your philosophy, you know, you've avoided these problematics of guilt, of infinite debt, you know, if you've created this polemic with psychoanalysis, why do you return to the complaint? And Deleuze says, well, if you look at the history of poetry, you'll see that the complaint is a very creative thing, and you can't understand poetry at all outside of lamentation. So that the great complaint, and then he forms a kind of concept of the great complaint, so the la grande plainte, so the great complaint, not just the kind of minor quibble, but a truly sublime complaint, he says, is something powerful, creative, but powerful to the extent that it actually overwhelms the person who would speak it. So Deleuze says behind every complaint there is also a basic formula, not the Lacanian, okay, never to be born, but the formula is whatever is happening is too much for me. That's it. So whenever you're complaining, essentially what you're saying is, hey, it's just too much. I can't deal with this. Whether, for example, it's a prophet who's complaining about why did God choose me? This is too much for me. I can't bear this burden. Or to use another example he uses, an old lady who has rheumatism and can't move, you know. That he says she's not so much complaining about the fact that she can't move, that she's lost her mobility, that would be a lack, but she's more complaining about a certain alien force that has taken hold of her appendages and is too much for her. So behind the lack, or behind a kind of impossibility or difficulty, you find a kind of positive force. And interestingly enough, kvetch, so the Yiddish kvetch, comes from the German kvetchen, which actually means to squeeze or to crush. So you could say that the kvetch is actually closer to the Deleuzian intuition. That you could say, underneath all this talk of sort of incapacities, limits, impossibilities, lacks, there's always a kind of forces that are squeezing and crushing you, positive forces that are overwhelming you. And the great complaint is the one that actually creates a song, let's say, a kind of poetic expression out of these forces. Doesn't seek to get rid of them, but to express them, to give them a space in life for which they're always too great or too much. Okay. The third aspect of the book is psychopathology. So I deal with pleasure as a kind of, and by pleasure I also mean very broadly terms like pleasure and enjoyment, or desire and drive, or also love. That I try to give a kind of understanding, a definition of these terms. And one of my interests is to go back to the 1960s and 70s French philosophy of desire, when this was expressed. And the confusion about that is that every philosopher seemed to have their favorite word. If you're a Deleuzian, if you're Deleuze, desire. That's your word, desire. Pleasure is not interesting. He says pleasure is a rotten idea. If you're Foucault, you say, no, pleasure is the interesting idea. Desire, terrible. It's too Christian. It's too psychoanalytic. Pleasure is interesting. We go back to the Greeks. If you're Lacanian, as you know, there's a distinction between pleasure and enjoyment. Enjoyment is the more interesting concept, and so on. So there's a kind of very interesting but very difficult debate, almost as if philosophers are trying to pick the most radical, sort of voluptuous term. And one of the ways, so I try to give a new spin on this, and one of the ways is to go back to, again, to the Greeks. And I think that the fundamental divergence, the beginning of this debate about pleasure and desire really comes from the debate between Plato and Aristotle. And to put it very simply, so it's very interesting, the debates about hedonism in Greek philosophy, to really boil it down, Plato would say that pleasure is always about filling a lack. And therefore, pleasure is always preceded by some kind of pain or some kind of missing something. Pleasure is the feeling of filling your lack. And Aristotle would say, absolutely not. Completely wrong picture. Pleasure is the enjoyment of an activity. It's an enjoyment of a force, of an energeia. He even invented a term that wasn't in the Greek language before, energeia, from which we actually get the idea of energy or the idea of reality. From energeia from the Greeks to you can trace the etymology, but this idea of the energy that actually animates and that makes alive and that makes the world come into being. So pleasure is something positive. Again, if you're a philosopher, you enjoy thinking, for example. If you're hungry, you want to eat and fulfill your appetite. That's kind of a Platonic idea. So the core of the dispute actually starts in Greek philosophy, whether or not pleasure should be understood as filling a lack or the satisfaction of a desire, or if it should be understood as the elaboration, the continuation, the unfolding of a power or a force. So I use this to give a kind of new grounding and new reading of the problems of pleasure, desire, drive, love, and so forth. Let me say, the last aspect of the book, then, is I'm very interested in a philosophy of psychopathology, even though I'm not a clinician. But I'm very interested in the kind of clinical literature. And I think both Lacan and Deleuze are quite interesting for sharing a kind of critique of a normative psychology, but in very different ways. And this is what I call the project of a clinical anthropology. And just to summarize that very quickly, clinical anthropology is the idea that what psychoanalysis discovered, what it formulated, as different sort of types of illnesses. And typically, you can reduce them in psychoanalysis, to cut a long story short, to three: neurosis, perversion, and psychosis. You know, in contemporary psychiatry, there's hundreds of categories. Psychoanalysis is much simpler. Because it gives structure, it doesn't just enumerate symptoms, but it tries to give kind of structural analysis of what's going on behind the symptoms. So typically, let's say there's only three. What clinical anthropology means is these kind of illnesses, mental illnesses, are not just kind of sicknesses one suffers from. It's not that there would be a kind of ideal of health, and that ideal of health coming under pressure or failing then turns into a kind of sickness. It's that neurosis, perversion, psychosis are actually three ways of being human. Every human somehow participates in these. And so the access to a kind of philosophical anthropology and understanding of what it means to be a human being goes through the study of psychopathology. Put differently, there was a nice moment in one of Lacan's seminars where a kind of auditor asks him, after all, why don't you ever talk about normal desire? And there's something reasonable about this question, because you would think, well, if psychoanalysis studies mental illness, it should also articulate an ideal of happiness or like good mental functioning. Shouldn't it have an idea of what health is? But Lacan's answer was, hey, I talk all the time about normal desire. There's even three kinds, neurotic, pervert, and psychotic. So that normality wouldn't be opposed to these different clinical structures, but that all these clinical types touch on universal human problems, and that the illnesses, different kinds of illnesses, involve exaggerations of what are essentially universal human problems. What are those universal human problems? For example, having a body. That's not something obvious. There's a lot of mental work goes into the idea of locating yourself into your body and feeling more or less at home in your body. So the idea that limits, constructing the limits of your body or the limits between the inside and the outside, is an actual universal human problem for which there's no good solution. You just have to make do somehow. If you really have a problem with that, then you're going to be more psychotic. Another universal human problem is sexuality. So how do you define yourself as a man and or woman? How do you understand or how do you live the kind of force, the pressure of the sexual drives, which, as Freud said, without going into that, but are not limited simply to like genital intercourse, but in fact have a very wide sort of remit throughout the body and through human life. If your main problem is with understanding sexuality, you're probably more pervert. Another kind of universal problem, what does the other want from me? What am I for the other? What do I want, after all? Is my existence justified or not? Why am I not allowed to do that? Why am I not allowed to do certain things? If your problem is dealing with the law, with the other's desire, with trying to figure out what you want, you're probably, like most of us, neurotics. Okay, so that's the problem of a kind of clinical anthropology. And just to tell also very briefly the distinction between a kind of Lacanian and a Deleuzian approach, which I think is very stimulating, even today, I really try to make a plea that I think some of these problems are very contemporary. That a kind of a Lacanian I would call a classical approach. And a classical approach would say that human existence has fundamental rifts, fundamental crises, contradictions that can never really be surmounted, but they can be dealt with in one way or another. So there's a kind of universal idea of a kind of crisis, a lack, so forth. That's what I would call kind of a classical approach. Deleuze and Deleuze and Guattari have a more, what I would call a romantic approach. So the idea that nature, the nature in you, is somehow fundamentally productive and even good, but it's so good it ends up creating a lot of problems. It's so powerful that it actually turns against itself and actually ruins itself or actually becomes alienated from its own force and develops all sorts of blockages, voids, contradictions, and so forth. So the problem of mental illness is actually those people who can't, you know, to put it in psychedelic language, if you can't handle the trip, you become ill somehow. This is a kind of more romantic approach, but both are based on a fundamental critique of the distinction between the normal and the pathological. Okay, I've probably already gone on long enough. Maybe I'll just read a quick passage, and then I'm happy to take, we can have a kind of discussion, questions, and then open the floor to complaints. I can also say that I start the book with a Jewish joke, so I happen to know something about this culture. But while I was doing research, I actually found quite interesting things in many different cultures. And I actually gave, when I was so working on this, I worked on the complaining just for a year alone as a kind of separate project. And I was giving lectures in different places, and it was very interesting to see people's responses. So I focus on a few specific cultures. One of the most interesting books on complaining is from an Russian American anthropologist studying Russian culture, and Nancy Rees, and she wrote a book called Russian Talk, and it was actually just about how Russians talk in their everyday lives, but in 1989, 1990, so during perestroika. And her thesis was the most kind of banal sort of everyday form of conversation was the litany. So I was looking at different cultures. So for example, I start the book with a joke, and the joke goes like this. There's two Jews on a train. It's a well-known genre of jokes. So there's two Jews on a train. There's an old man and a young man. And the old man is keeps saying, like, "Oy, am I thirsty. I'm so thirsty. Oy, I'm so thirsty," you know? It's all kind of foreshadowing. But he doesn't stop. So again, like, the young man's just sitting in front of him. "I'm so thirsty. Oy, am I thirsty." So finally, the young man, like, can't take it anymore, goes to the train car where there's drinks. He buys a kind of glass of water, brings it back, gives it to the old man. The old man drinks it down, looks satisfied. Okay, it's quiet again. Everything's fine. But then he's looking at the older man, and he can see that the old man is kind of getting nervous, you know? And finally, he can't take it anymore, and he just blurts out, like, "Oy, I was so thirsty. Oh, I was so thirsty." So I sort of start with this. And I think if you really analyze this joke, which I do at length, so I'm not going to... If you really overanalyze this joke, I think it pretty much tells you everything you need to know about the human desire. So as I say, you can analyze it in terms of what is being complained about, so the object of complaint. You can analyze it in terms of an intersubjective drama, so who is being complained to, the addressee. And you can analyze it also in terms of simply the activity of complaining itself, the pleasure of the activity of complaining. But as I was saying, when I was giving this lecture in different places, it was very interesting to see the reactions of the audience. And I can say the most enthusiastic auditors I ever had were the Portuguese. So I gave this lecture in Lisbon. There was a very small but very enthusiastic attendance. I think there were 6 people, but they refused to let me go for like 4 or 5 hours. And they honestly tried to convince me that the Portuguese were truly the masters of complaint and they would put Jews to shame on this. And of course, then later I had a student who was, because I was also teaching this, and I had a student who worked on and wrote a very interesting research paper on fado. And fado is a great sort of Portuguese tradition, which is a kind of elaborated complaint. And it's true that, like, specifically Portuguese culture really traces its history back to very specific kind of complaints against the Spanish and so forth. So different cultures, of course, have given the term different valences. It means something different, also historical terms. So there's some trivia also in this lecture of complaining. I discovered Chaucer, for instance, was the first to actually use the word complaint, which he borrowed from the French, came from French poetry. And maybe I can read that because it's so delightful, that Chaucer's very last poem, the last poem he ever wrote, was a kind of parody of courtly love. And also I talk about the poetry of courtly love at length because it was the really great poetry of the amatory, the love complaint. And somehow we've borrowed from courtly love this idea that to love means to complain, or perhaps it's complaining that one really loves in the end. But Chaucer, and this is very relevant for any authors in this room, Chaucer, at the end of his life, wrote a kind of parody of a courtly love poem, but he's not writing the kind of plea to the lady, the cruel lady, who won't satisfy the desires, but he's pleading with his money bag, his wallet, which is sadly empty. No one's paying him for his writing. So Chaucer says, "To you, my purse, you whom I will not slight for any other, you, my lady dear, bitterly I complain, for you are so light that certainly you give me heavy cheer. I had as life be laid upon my bier, and hoping for your mercy, thus I cry, be heavy again, for if not, I shall die." That's his last poem. So again, I'm happy to discuss that. I think complaining also is a very rich phenomena. I will just mention, so I'll just read one paragraph that one of the writers I discovered that I quite like is a French writer, not so well known, Georges Perros, and he was a writer of aphorisms. And he had 2 very wonderful lines, I think, about pleasure and the paradoxes of pleasure. One he said, one line is, let me see if I remember correctly. Yes, nothing proves that pleasure is a happy affair. So you can enjoy, but don't confuse enjoyment with like just a kind of well-being or a kind of a pleasant feeling. And in fact, this relates also to the philosophy of Aristotle, because Aristotle would say pleasure has nothing to do with feeling or consciousness. Pleasure just means being absorbed in what you're doing. And of course, you can be absorbed in what you're doing, but what you're doing can also be quite painful, for example. So, you know, there are people who really enjoy complaining. But of course, complaining is something, you know, very negative, annoying, unbearable, and so forth. But they can turn it into a source of pleasure because they get even kind of quasi-hypnotized by a sort of discourse that never ends and so forth. But another line of Perrault's, and I'll just end on this, which I think is really wonderful. He says, it's true that people go to a lot of trouble in order to be unhappy, but are they? Why is this such a good line? I think this expresses, if I can kind of exaggerate, I think this expresses the very core of a modern ethics, actually, which reverses a kind of Aristotelian ethics. And still, in our spontaneous, I don't know, everyday attitudes, our life, but also in a lot of sort of critical literature, still is somehow broadly Aristotelian, in the sense that the picture we have of moral life is that human beings are striving to be happy in some ways, that they're striving to actualize their powers and capacities, and that, of course, there's all sorts of obstacles to this along the way, and hitting upon these obstacles makes you unhappy, and sometimes you can really fail entirely, but fundamentally, there's a basic force in you that's trying to realize itself, that there's a basic kind of striving for happiness. Okay, if you're happy or not, it's also largely a matter of luck, but the problems come from external impediments, obstacles, contradictions, you know, limits, and so forth. I think Perrault says just the opposite. So I'll read. The wording in Perrault is very precise. Instead of the standard picture of man striving after happiness but encountering all sorts of conflicts and obstacles along the way, Perrault suggests just the opposite. There's something deeply flawed about the human condition, such that people actively sabotage their own desires and aspirations, maneuvering in ways that are often unbeknownst to themselves, to ensure that things turn out badly. Now, if we were to stop at this insight, we would remain at the level of tragedy. But the situation is even worse. The human condition is so miserable that it does not even manage to successfully negate itself. So this is what the second sentence tells us with its kind of skeptical, the sly skeptical retort. But are they? Are they? Are we really so unhappy? So you could say, in spite of their best efforts for the worst and loud protest to the contrary, people turn out to be oddly content in their discontent. It is not that the negative flips over into the positive, but something more subtle and elusive takes place. The negative finds itself undermined or deviated from within, and it is this secondary deviation, the kind of screwing up of the discontent, that provides the rich matter of comedy. So to vary a phrase from Freud, you could say that people enjoy less than they imagine, kind of hedonistic fantasies and images of total gratification that fill our heads, or, for example, that one gets from the consumer culture, from advertising. So I think we enjoy less than we imagine we're enjoying, but we enjoy far more than we think we are. So when and where it's least expected or even wanted, a kind of insistent pleasure can suddenly crop up. So here we can offer a very general thesis concerning ethics. I think in modern times, in modernity, happiness is not the direct aim of life. It's not the sort of telos of a fully actualized being, but it's the product, or even better, it's the byproduct of a kind of double failure. So this is a kind of negative Aristotelianism with an ironically optimistic or kind of ironically comic twist, that man lives by failing not to flourish. Or to put it otherwise, the human being is that animal that strives to sabotage its own being, but is so incompetent it ends up bungling even that. And I think this is what's at stake in the Freudian conception of the symptom, which is a kind of offbeat vitality, and it condenses both of these dimensions. So even in this very old, I mean, everybody, let's say, knows these kind of received ideas from psychoanalysis, but I think we can even find in these, you know, old Freudian insights something new or something fresh. So, of course, the paradigm case in pleasure and psychoanalysis is that really weird idea of a pleasure not felt as such. So this idea of neurotic unpleasure, that somehow you're doing something and you don't want to, or you're complaining about it, but nevertheless, you're doing it. And that attachment to whatever that thing is you're doing or repeating bears witness to some kind of enjoyment, even though you're not enjoying, let's say, even though you don't have the feeling of enjoyment, you don't have the feeling of pleasure. That's the challenge of psychoanalysis. If you take psychoanalysis seriously as a philosopher, it means explaining that weird situation. If you don't take it seriously, okay, forget the whole thing. Go back to your very simplistic idea that we basically just want pleasure and avoid pain and so forth. And do a degree in economics. And okay, I apologize for the economics bashing. And I'm still wounded from the elections last night. Okay, so just to finish this paragraph and then I end. So the incredible the Freudian symptom, I think, is a kind of double story. It's both the Freudian symptom is interesting because it's both tragic and comic. Your symptoms are both tragic and comic. So they're tragic in the sense that every symptom is somehow a tale, a story of an inescapable conflict and a kind of fatal destiny. But on the other hand, it's also the story about the incredible plasticity of life that manages to get by in the most strange and surprising ways. So if repression is tragic, the return of the repressed is kind of comic, or at least it contains the kernel of comedy. And in fact, Freud shows, so in Jokes in the Relation to the Unconscious, that unconscious mental processes employ the same basic mechanisms that are used in jokes. But the former, so your unconscious symptoms, whatever, are not really funny because they're not constrained by the desire to communicate with an audience. So they're not constrained by that desire to entertain or connect with another person. So you could say that the unconscious is a kind of incredibly private comedy club of bad puns and failed routines. So it's a kind of autistic comedy that's not funny to anybody somehow except yourself on some very odd level. So you could say, again, to repeat myself, you could say first there's a kind of act of brutal exclusion, so the expulsion of whatever is horrible, painful, inadmissible from the psyche. And then there follows a kind of comic moment when that which has been excluded tries to sneak back into consciousness, as it were, wearing a fake beard. So this would be the whole kind of farcical play of disguises, displacements, transformations that make up the unconscious. So of not getting what you want, but enjoying something else that is actually what you wanted anyway. Somehow a kind of Freudian formula, I think. And then I would say, except the situation is somehow even a little bit more complex since the temporal order is jumbled up. So it's not just first, second, but somehow it happens simultaneously. So you could say that in the neurotic symptom, these kind of two historical moments, recall Marx, the two historical moments that Marx described as occurring one after the other. So first as tragedy, then as farce. So you know, first there's Napoleon's coup in 1799, then you have the nephew's seizure of power much later, which is a kind of farcical repeat of that. You could say that this comedy, this kind of tragedy and farce happens simultaneously in a symptom, or the symptom, kind of symptom you have, is at the same time the first time is tragedy, the second time is farce. It kind of condenses both those dimensions. Okay. Obviously, I enjoy what I do, so I can keep going on and on and on. One should strive to exemplify one's own theories, I suppose. But maybe that's a nice point to conclude and to have a discussion.
Thank you, Aaron. Yeah? Mike, I'd like to ask a question.
Aaron, just a quick question of information. Have you?
Yeah.
I don't remember his name, but he's been. I've heard him on the radio, and the author of Born to Kvetch,
Michael Wex.
Yes.
I cite it. It's actually. Okay. I think I can be proud to say that the very first footnote in the book is to Michael Wex, Born to Kvetch. Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay, as a fellow, that's very interesting because I wonder how he feels about being cited in an academic book. He wrote that your story about, oy, am I thirsty,
yes.
Oy, am I thirsty, oh, was I thirsty, oy, was I thirsty.
Yes.
Was he told that story when he was interviewed on WNYC.
So in his book, so in the next paragraph of my book, I cite Wex, and Wex actually, I knew this joke, for whatever that's worth. I knew this joke before I read one. Everybody knows it. Sorry, I just had to. I didn't get it from, but okay. But actually, he writes extensively about this joke as the kind of paradigm. I mean, it's very funny in his book. He says it's the paradigm of the Yiddish-speaking mindset. And his line, so I quote him, which I think is very nice. I mean, I'll just read it. He says, so this is a quote from Wex. He says, "If the stones 'I can't get no satisfaction' had been written in Yiddish, it would have been called 'I love to keep telling you that I can't get no satisfaction, because telling you I'm not satisfied is all that can satisfy me.'" And so, okay, being an academic, I argue that this really exemplifies that kind of abstruse Lacanian theory of need, demand, and desire. It shows like the differences between those, and that the desire can never be satisfied because you always are demanding an object that's not it, for instance. So indeed, I found, you know, honestly, in terms of the literature on complaining, I mean, I'm also kind of making a joke about that there's really none. And as far as I know, I mean, hardly any philosophers have written about that. Of course, everybody writes about criticism and critique. But two of the most kind of stimulating books that I read was Michael Wex, so this Born to Kvetch, which I think is quite a serious book. It's quite a good book. It was a bestseller, I think, but it's belied by a very cheesy cover. But it's actually very, very solid book, very good scholarship. I mean, it's a very interesting book. And also Nancy Rees, who I mentioned, so her book, Russian Talk. And I think those are, for me, those are the two main like sources for sort of everyday complaining outside of philosophy and so forth. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm not gonna go actually to the philosophy and that Greek trajectory that you were delineating and that ultimate complaint that you were talking about not to be born. Because it seems to me that there is something different that could happen if you think about it religiously rather than philosophically. Bear with me. I mean, why is the Jewish tradition so big on kvetching, other than because it's basically the Messiah is not here? The moment the Messiah will come, we will not complain. Isn't this the meaning of
heaven forbid, heaven forbid.
I know. Precisely. And that's what makes you a good Jew. I mean, but that's the definition of messianism. I mean, in Thomas Aquinas, he will say, you know, once the Messiah will, I mean.
But then the Christians also developed a quite interesting discourse on complaining, this kind of infinite, you know, misericordia, and this kind, you know, even though the Messiah has arrived, but it arrives in the form of a kind of then glorification and a kind of liturgy of suffering, of course.
Precisely.
Which is why, you know, to be overly simplistic, but no, really why psychoanalytic authors tend to like associate Christianity more with perversion, Judaism more with neurosis. But okay, that's a very, it's too generalizing.
No, but that's actually...
I mean, there's something to it, though.
But that's actually where I wanted to go, because, you know, if everybody is complaining, all the Jews in ancient, around year zero, complain about the empire, about the condition, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And then comes this dude, and he's like basically negating that. And they will hate him precisely because he is the anti-complainer in certain ways. But then, and that's right, what actually turns him into the best Jew ever, because his last words are basically, "God, why have you forsaken me?"
Right, which is the great Christian complaint at some.
But I would want to claim that this is actually the ultimate complaint. Not, I'd rather not be, but because, you know, even if my shoelaces are open and I complain, who am I complaining to?
Exactly.
I mean, the absence of God in your discourse,
right,
makes me a little bit. That's my critique: is that it seems that all complaint is about God.
Okay.
That God is not doing what he's supposed to do.
Let me answer that. I mean, I think that's a very interesting perspective. And of course, like, and if I just tell you the truth on the side, so you just forget this quickly as soon as you leave the room. One of the problems I had writing this book was that originally I wanted to write this preface about complaining as a kind of odd way into the problematic to reintroduce some philosophical problems through a different filter. And I got kind of seduced by my own topic and thought, oh, this is much better than writing about Deleuze and Lacan. Why don't I just write a book about complaining? So anyway, okay, that's neither here nor there. Now, about the religion, of course you could expand. That would be very interesting then to expand, you know, complaining as a kind of literary genre and a genre of religion and what that means and to analyze it in those terms. Now, I think that the idea of focusing on the addressee, so also in the book, I talk about, so at the very beginning, I say this joke about the "I'm so thirsty" can be analyzed in terms of what is complained about, the object of complaint, who you complain to, so the addressee, and also the activity. And then I add a fourth, which is you could ask the question, who is complaining? That's very interesting in psychoanalysis. Again, to be very vulgar, you say, when I'm speaking in psychoanalysis, the first thing you have is a kind of undermining of that idea that your speech necessarily comes from you. So you learn a certain kind of anonymization, or the idea that somehow speech is always a bit ventriloquized. To be very simplistic, hey, am I complaining, or is that my father saying that? Okay. So you can also ask, well, who is the subject of complaint? But I don't think the addressee, so the very fact that you focus so much on the addressee, I complain too, is the most interesting or ultimate dimension of complaint. And most of the authors, and especially the two authors I'm looking at most intensely, so Lacan, Deleuze, I think would contest that. That the idea that the addressee of complaint, there's a beyond of that. That's somehow, to use a technical term, it's somehow a kind of imaginary structure. Because when you address the other, you're also asking for a kind of recompense, recognition, restitution. Why did you forgive me? Save me. Be a better father. Everybody says that. Everybody knows that. The father somehow abandoned you at some point. They weren't good enough. So why did you? But for both Lacan and Deleuze, that's not the ultimate level of complaining. Deleuze would say, eventually, complaint is not about the relation to the other. And it's not even looking for recognition. It's actually somehow a kind of song of a force that's overwhelming. And the elaboration of that force is truly the highest level of complaint. And that force is not directed towards, it's not looking to be recognized, it's not looking to be changed, restituted, compensation, it's not caught up in dynamics of guilt and debt. So that would be the Deleuzean answer. The Lacanian answer also, different but somehow similar, that never being born, that's nobody's fault. You can't blame somebody. Of course, if you're neurotic, you will always find somebody to blame. And your desire can be caught up in that. That powerful sense of blame and of addressing another to fix it, or that they should at least take on the burden of my life, for example. But you should pass through that, or that you find the ultimate level of complaint is not the one directed to the other. And religion is very good at mobilizing. So that's also the hold religion has on us. I mean, why religion doesn't die? I mean, what is religion? It's not just a set of beliefs. It's something that works on very basic structures of your desire. And religion captures you precisely by creating a whole mythology about who's at fault, who screwed up. Oh, but okay, God screwed up, but but on the other hand, you shouldn't blame God because God is great, et cetera, et cetera. It develops a very elaborate discourse around this. That would be my answer.
But I mean, of course, God is not there. He never answers you, whatever it is. I mean, think about complaints as kind of like profane prayer. And
yes.
Imagine if you praying for something.
I totally agree with that. Happen. I totally agree with that.
What? It's not supposed to happen, what I'm asking for.
Right.
And isn't that what complaints?
I totally agree. I think that's a really apt metaphor, and I even write at one point as a kind of provocation. I mean, why don't we see complaint as something, a great activity that you can develop, like dancing, a festival of like a great dancer. You know, what is it if you can not just dance, but a great, if you really devote yourself to dancing. You would also, dancers would say something like, it's not just me dancing, but like the force of that activity elaborates itself through me, through my body, that I kind of give myself over to another force. Prayer, the real great prayers, not just people mumbling in a car, but really, you devote your life, then you see that the prayer is something greater than you, like the God that comes through you. And why can't complaining be like that too? That's my
very quick question on this. When does the word, when do the letters C-O-M attach themselves to plaint?
I'm not sure. That's something interesting that I hadn't thought of till later. And here's one idea to test it, whatever. The plaint, for example, it's coming from the French, the plaint. The plaint, you could say, to be plaintive, maybe is a more pure expression, for example, of pain, of annoyance, of disagreement. Whereas the complaint with, goes more in the direction of what David was saying, that's when the pure expression, let's say, of a kind of disagreement, of discontent, of a pain, actually becomes directed towards the other to fix it.
For example,
to be recognized in my complaint. Right.
The calm is part of the addressee for you.
I think so. That's
it's not shared.
Well, yes, others. Shared, it's but then shared in a kind of, then you enter into the universe of identification. Mm-hmm. So we're together, and then, you know, you have the whole community structure. But it's just, it's an interesting question, actually. I don't, it's just something I'm thinking about now, so they're just thinking out loud on this, but, yeah.
There's a question here.
Sorry, actually, continuing of, on what you were saying about this shared feeling, actually, I'm really interested in this aspect of complaint as a social bonding factor.
Right.
Because you're talking mostly about an individual experience, but for me, it's, and going beyond, and not only about identification in terms of religion, because this is one thing, but, you know, in this kind of one-to-one dialogue situation. So this is the first question, and
right.
the second okay, maybe you first ask.
Well, again, I mean, I completely agree with you, and I also use Nancy Rees as a kind of the basis for my discussion about that, that how complaint can create a whole community of, like, shared suffering, and that's how she analyzes especially Slavic cultures. So coming from Poland, you understand this immediately. One of the examples that, I mean, so the other times when I was giving the lecture, when it was really, let's say, when I connected with the audiences, mostly in Eastern European countries also. But one of the examples
are you complaining
that she
about
gives,
this audience?
What?
Are you complaining about this audience?
Yeah, so I don't know about you guys. No, sorry. I apologize. No, one of the examples that she gives that I think is very interesting is that she says, which is very un-American, she says in these Slavic cultures, sometimes you complain strategically when things are going good. And the reason why you complain when things are going good is because you want to hide your success, your relative success, you want to hide that from the other. Why would you want to do that? Because you want to avoid shaming the other. So for example, if I have some extra vacation days, or maybe I just have, you know, I don't know, some precious commodity, some bread that somebody else couldn't buy, communist times, I'll even complain a little bit more about how hard things are, so that I'll mask my relative success vis-a-vis the other. And then, of course, complaining here has a more extravagant dimension than that. It's not only practical, sort of regulating your affairs with the other, but you complain specifically because you're worried that if you brag about, I'm going to go on vacation next week, that somebody will take it away. The flight will be canceled. So magically, it will go away. So it's kind of superstitious. There's something superstitious also about this complaining. Now, what's interesting is in the Slavic culture, the Slavic idea of over-complaining, you have the opposite in kind of American culture, if I can just be very cliche here, the American culture of kind of over-performing your enjoyment, so compulsive positivity. You know, if things are good, if things are going bad, you should always, everything is always better than it is. You know, how are you? Great, everything's great. It's awesome, it's amazing, and so forth. And you could say that the irony is that the relative, you could say relatively poorer Eastern countries actually deal with the problem of surplus. Surplus is embarrassing. You have to mask it. Whereas American societies, of course, are embarrassed about lack, which is very funny. It's just the opposite. You're embarrassed about lack, and you have to mask that. And then, just to end this analysis, then the kind of conclusion I draw from this is not the kind of commonsensical moral lesson that couldn't we just balance the two between the Slavics and the Americans? So couldn't you just complain when things are bad. If things are good, you can be excited, but don't, you know, the level should be the same. And I think that that's not how culture works, that somehow human enjoyment is always or kind of oscillating between too much and too little, that there's kind of no golden mean. This is the difference between moderns, like Freud, for example, and Aristotelians, that there's somehow no sort of harmony, or there's no sort of natural balance. And what culture provides is sort of different practices that sort of, they don't contain the excess, or they don't fulfill the lack, but they somehow allow you to inscribe that turbulence in the social space. So that somehow Slavic grumbling and American sort of compulsive positivity are two different strategies for inscribing the fact that desire is unbalanced. So that would be, but I agree with you about the social
dimension. Two more questions and.
Yeah, so I was really interested in where you think complaint fits in American culture, since we have a culture of compulsive positivity, and especially in a phenomenon that I'm sure everyone's interested in, Donald Trump, for example. He's, you know, someone who expresses himself with these words of compulsive positivity, tremendous, amazing, wonderful, but is also expressing a tremendous complaint at the same time. So what do you think about the American orientation toward complaint?
You know, unfortunately, I don't think I have a... You know, it makes me think back to an earlier phenomena from the 80s, like the cultural wars in the 80s. And, you know, one of the kind of big sellers was a book called The Culture of Complaint. And The Culture of Complaint was actually about this problem of guilt and of restitution. And I think a lot of, so if I can go back, if I can step back a few decades, I think a lot of that, specifically American discourse and really bound up with the culture wars, was really about this idea that you shouldn't, you know, our culture is too much of a complaining culture, and we're always looking for the other, the government, for instance, to indemnify us for our losses. And this was part of a very conservative, so critique, that we shouldn't be looking for indemnification, that we shouldn't be looking for restitution. Strangely enough, you know, the philosophers I'm investigating would kind of agree with that, that they're looking at a complaint that would be beyond restitution, beyond recognition. But then they're operating on quite a different level. But I think that comes back today, that like it's very contradictory. I mean, it's extremely contradictory, these complaints, because there's this dimension, you know, don't complain, you should just, you know, make your life yourself. Don't blame the society. So there's a kind of, you know, and that's generally an extremely conservative gesture. But it's very, just very preliminary what I'm saying right now. But anyway.
So I was wondering how usually there's the basic contrast between Lacan and Deleuze about how they respond to the reality of the signifier.
Right.
And so I'm wondering how that maps onto your argument, because the way I'm thinking of it in terms of what you've said so far is that, first of all, there's kind of a paradox in Lacan that on the one hand, he has the short session, which is to stop people from compulsive complaining, right? Because they know that they have a routine, and then he wants to break that routine because that's sort of part of their problem. But at the same time, because of the fact that Lacan has a much more, a closer affinity with the signifier, that he would be one that would be more apt to say that the complaint is a kind of song, that if you sort of push it in a certain direction, if you're submitting to the signifier, and there's sort of there's play in that, whereas like maybe sort of Deleuze would be sort of somebody who would pay attention to somatics or let's say effect or so what do you make of that sort of the linguistic non-linguistic division between the two?
Okay, that's of course a huge and very difficult question. So, you know, because basically to rephrase what you're asking is Lacan, Deleuze, how do they understand the relationship between language and the body? Now, That's a very important question that I kind of deal with at length. And specifically, there's a kind of chapter devoted towards Deleuze's logic of sense. And I also try to disentangle, to actually suggest how Lacan's approach to language is different than Deleuze's. How to summarize that very, very briefly? I mean, look, there's a number of cliches floating out there that I think are wrong, and that would be stuff like Lacanian theory has no understanding of the body, for instance, or Deleuze's. Okay, this is not correct. But I would say rather that they're both very fascinated with the intersection between language and the body. So it's not that one starts from the body, one starts from language, but I think both are interested in that intersection where they get entangled. But they understand that intersection differently. So that's the first step to make. It's not that simply one privileges one term, the other privilege. I think they're both interested in how these terms are interconnected in the mode that they never fall together with each other. So that the body and the mind, if you want to put it that way, or body and language, are somehow entangled. There's a kind of synthesis, but they would insist that it's a kind of anti-synthetic synthesis, or they don't sort of naturally or easily flow into each other. There's some kind of difficult and interesting point there, the point where they intersect. Okay, that would be the first step. And then the second step would be, okay, but then how do they grasp that difference? And if I can just give, instead of giving an answer, if I can give just an example. Deleuze, in his idea of sense, indeed, you're right that it's somehow much closer to reality, much closer to like bodily processes. So that somehow sense is something that emerges from out of bodies impacting each other, bodies cutting into one another, bodies transforming each other. Things, just in the very broad sense, okay? That language somehow comes out of that, but also emancipates itself from those kind of transformations, impacts, and so forth, and asserts its relative autonomy from them. Okay, if that makes sense. Lacan would actually start more from like the idea that you confront language as something disconnected from everything. And let me try to make some sense out of that. The very simple example that I analyze at length, so I like comedians, Larry David gets in here, and Louis C.K. Now, Louis C.K. has a wonderful monologue where he's talking about his child, and he tells, maybe you've seen this, where he talks about the why. So, you know, children are always asking this question, why? And Louis C.K. has this wonderful sort of dialogue about this, that actually, he, as he calls it, it's an insane deconstruction. Like, it just drives you crazy. So, you know, and he starts off, why is there rain pouring out of the cloud? Well, clouds form when they're vapor. Well, why is there vapor? And so, and finally, Louis C.K. says, like, I'm just going to say, he says, like, well, I don't know. That's all I know. And then the child says, why? Why is that all you know? So then he shifts tack, and he explains, well, I didn't listen in school. Why didn't you listen in school? Well, because I was a shitty student. Why? Because my parents don't care about me. Why didn't your parents? Because we're all alone in the universe. Fuck it. So first you have the problem of knowledge. Then you have the kind of Oedipal problem, that the family structure sucks. And then he says it gets even weirder than that. That he says eventually, and here he shifts to a philosophical problematic, he says, well, why? Well, because some things are and some things are not. Well, why? Because non-being can't be. Why? Well, because if non-being could be, then there'd be all these crazy things like ants dancing around in top hats. And okay, so then eventually at the end of the routine, he just says, you know, shut the fuck up and eat your French fries. And I think this is more Lacanian, because the idea that, in the sense, when you confront language and when you try to use language, so the child there is not just being obnoxious, but the child is actually not even interacting with the parents, but is testing how language works. And what the child bumps up against is that language doesn't ground itself anywhere solid. That somehow the child gets, has a sense that language is a fiction. And in this fictional universe, fictions relate to each other. And eventually, and there's no solid point where you say, ah, thank God, language hooked onto reality there, I'm satisfied. That in language, you can always pose another question. And then you see that language fundamentally has an authoritarian structure. Because to exist in language means to accept some conventions because somebody said so, and that you should shut up at a certain point. So that for Lacan, like to enter into language, have a sense for language, is immediately to confront the problem of authority and to understand that there's a kind of meaninglessness to it all, that there's no answer to your question, so that there's a kind of lack of meaning, a lack of sense. And that lack of sense is the, precisely the place where authority captures you and links to the body. Deleuze does not. Deleuze also has a theory of authority, so, but he doesn't start from that point. He starts from a non-authoritarian conception of sense, of language germinating out of things. And that's interesting. But they're both interested, again, to repeat myself, on that link between language and the body. But Lacan will highlight from the very beginning this problem of a confrontation with authority or a confrontation with the law. And Deleuze will not. He will see that as a secondary problematic founded on a more primary aspect of language. Lacan will be very dubious of that. That, of course, there is also an account of this melding of language and the body. But fundamentally, there's a kind of problem of authority. And that all pathological types are all ways of somehow situating yourself vis-a-vis this problem of authority. So, okay. That would be the kind of short answer, but it's, yeah.
I think we're going to stop the Q&A there. Okay. We do have some beers, if you would like one. We do ask you to come to that open mic. And
vent. This is your opportunity.
This is your opportunity to think veg and earn a beer.
Drink and
they
kvetch.
Will be recorded and put on our website. And 1 minute or less. No kvetch can go on for more than 1 minute. So.
Unless it's really masterful. You know,
is there a free book for the best kvetch? We don't have any books left.
Do we have any books left?
I don't know. Do you have a book left?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, let's say that it will be arbitrary and capricious. If there's an amazing kvetch, we might be overwhelmed.
Yes, we may give you something.
You just get a book. Something.
Okay, anyway, thank you. Thank you very much. It's fun. No, but you know,